Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars Rebel Dawn, Book 3 in the Han Solo Trilogy by A.C. Crispin. Han Solo leaned forward in the pilot's seat of the Wayward Girl. "Entering atmosphere, Captain," he said. One-handed, his co-pilot made an adjustment. Han had met Jadana Valaz 2 days ago, after she'd advertised from Alderaan on the Spacernets for a pilot to fly her ship to Cloud City on the planet B-Spin, after her arm had been injured. Han Solo had his own reasons for needing a ride to B-Spin. If it hadn't been for Jadana, he'd have had to dip into his rapidly dwindling stash of credits to buy passage for himself on a commercial vessel. With the credits she'd promised him, he'd be able to afford a cheap room and a few meals during the big Sabacc tournament. The buy-in alone was a staggering 10,000 credits. Han had barely managed to scrape those credits together. The Corellian wished for a moment that Chewie were here with him, but he'd had to leave the Wookiee behind in their little flat on Nar Shaddaa because he couldn't afford passage for two. Han was staking everything on this gamble. He'd always been lucky at Sabacc, but would luck be enough to let him win? He'd be playing against professional gamblers like Lando Calrissian. The Corellian swallowed, then resolutely concentrated on his piloting. This was no time to get an attack of nerves. Staying on their approach vector, Han sent them skimming over the domed buildings of the cityscape in the clouds and brought the girl down in a perfect landing. After receiving his pay and saying farewell to Captain Valaz, Han hailed a robo-hack to take him to the posh Yarith B-Spin Hotel, where the Sabacc tournament was being held. Minutes later, Han's robo-hack pulled up before the Yarith B-Spin. Han saw a sign reading Tournament Registration in at least 20 languages and followed the arrow up the glide lift to the mezzanine. Han Solo had made it through the first day of play on luck and by the skin of his teeth. One of the onlookers was rooting for Han to win, though the Corellian had no idea she was anywhere within parsecs of B-Spin. And if Bria Theron had anything to say about it, he wouldn't find out. She stood at the back of the hollow projection lounge, watching the broadcast of the game intently, hoping for a close-up of Han. Silently, she rejoiced that he'd made it this far. If only he'd win, she thought. Han deserves a big break. If he had a lot of credits, he wouldn't have to risk his life as a smuggler. Something rustled at Bria's side, and she turned to find her aide, a Corellian named Jace Powell, beside her. Commander, the representatives from Alderaan have arrived. They're on their way to the meeting site. Time to get on with her mission here in Cloud City. When Bria had discovered that Cloud City would be hosting the big Sabacc tournament, she realized that this was the ideal location for a top-secret meeting between representatives of several of the rebellions. Any intelligence operative knew that the easiest place to hide was in a crowd. With so many ships coming and going, a few humans, a Sullustan and a Duros meeting in a hotel conference room on Cloud City would arouse little interest from anyone. When she reached the meeting room, she tapped out her coded signal and was admitted. Bria seated herself at the long table and formally brought the meeting to order. "Fellow rebels," she said, speaking with the quiet authority of someone who had done this many times before, "I thank you for risking your lives in our cause. We of the Corellian rebel movement are contacting other underground groups like our own, urging all the various rebel groups to unite. Only as a strong, cohesive group can we have any hope of eventual victory over the Empire." She paused. "We know how taxing it can be for different species to work together. Disparate ethical and moral systems, ideologies, religions, not to mention equipment and weapon design differences, all of these things can present problems." Bria faced her onlookers steadily. But my friends, unite we must. Somehow we must find ways to work around our differences. The Duros representative tapped his fingers on the table. Your words are stirring, Commander. In spirit, I agree with them, but let us face facts here. In asking the non-human worlds to ally with you, you are asking us to put ourselves at far greater risk. Everyone knows the Emperor's disdain for non-humans. If an alliance challenged Palpatine's forces and lost, the Emperor's wrath would be mostly directed at the non-human worlds. He might well destroy us as a lesson to the human rebels. Bria nodded. Your point is well taken, Gensar. She glanced around the table. Minister Dalny, what are your thoughts?
We of Alderaan have supported the rebel movement from the beginning, the man said. We have provided intelligence, funding, and technical expertise, but this talk of battles is anathema to us. We are a peaceful world, and the way of the warrior is abhorrent to us.
Bria gazed at Dalny somberly. It is possible, Minister, she said, that Alderaan may not have the option to refrain from violence. She turned to the little Sulistan. Sion Tev, what are your initial thoughts?
Commander, my people are so crushed beneath the heel of the Empire that few of them have the wherewithal to plot any kind of rebellion. If we were to join a rebel alliance, it would cause civil war.
Bria sighed. It's going to be a long conference, she thought bleakly.
I can't believe I've made it this far, Han thought wearily as he eased himself into the seat at the one remaining Sabacc table. It was night on the fourth day of the tournament, and only the finalists were left. If only my luck holds out a little longer.
The other finalists had also taken their places around the table. A diminutive Chadra fan, a Bothan male, and a Rhodian female. As Han glanced around at his fellow players, the last player, another human, sat down opposite Han in the last empty chair. Han groaned inwardly. Somehow I knew this would happen. What chance can I have against a professional like Lando Calrissian? Lando nodded tightly to his friend. Han nodded back. Forcing himself to sit up straight, Han picked up his first hand of card chips. 3.5 hours later, the Bothan and the Rhodian had been eliminated. Han assessed his hand. He had the card chip for endurance, which had the value of -8. Appropriate, Han thought. This battle is becoming one of endurance. He also had the Ace of Staves with a value of +15, and the Six of Flasks, value +6. 13. He needed to take another card to build toward a pure Sabacc, that is, card chips totaling exactly 23. I'll take a card, Han said. The dealer tossed one down on the table. Han picked it up, saw with a sinking feeling that it was Demise, with a value of -13.
Great! I'm farther away than ever.
Just then the card randomizer, an electric current which alters the value of card chips at random intervals throughout the game, rippled, and Han's cards changed before his eyes. Han now had the Queen of Air and Darkness, with a value of -2, plus the Five of Coins, the Six of Staves, and the Master of Coins, with a value of 14. Total value, 23. His heart leaped. Pure Sabacc! With this hand, he could win the tournament. There was only one hand that could beat him, and that was an idiot's array. Han took a deep breath, then pushed forward all but one of his stacks of credit chips into the pot. For a moment, he considered tossing all his cards into the interference field to freeze their value, but then his opponents would know for sure he wasn't bluffing. Hold steady, he thought to his card chips, willing the randomizer not to change the patterns. On Han's right, the little Chadra fan's huge ears flickered rapidly back and forth, then he uttered the faintest of squeaks. Deliberately, precisely, the alien folded his card chips and placed them on the table, then got up and walked away. Han stared at his card chips. Hold, hold! His pulse was hammering and he hoped Lando couldn't see it. The professional gambler hesitated for a long second, then requested a card. Han's blood rushed in his ears as slowly and deliberately Calrissian extended a hand and placed a card chip face down into the interference field. Han stiffened. He'd caught just a glimpse of the primary color of the card chip reflected against the faint ionization of the field. Violet. If Han's bleary eyes weren't playing tricks on him,
That meant the card chip was the idiot, the most vital card in the idiot's array. Han tried to swallow, but his mouth was too dry. Lando is an expert at this, he thought. He could have put that card down in just that manner, knowing I'd see its telltale color and guess that he's holding the idiot to bluff me. Or am I imagining things? Han looked back up at his opponent. Lando was holding two cards in his hand now. The professional gambler smiled at his friend. Then, quickly punching a notation onto a data card, he pushed it and his few remaining credit chips towards Han. My marker, he said in his smoothest, most mellow tones. Good for any ship on my lot. Your choice of my stock. The dealer turned to Han.
Is that acceptable to you, Solo?
Han's mouth was so dry he didn't dare speak, but he nodded. Have to stay calm. Think, Han ordered himself. Does he have the idiot's array, or is he bluffing? There was only one way to find out. Hold, hold, he ordered his hand, and slowly, deliberately, he pushed forward his last stack of chips. I call, he said. His voice emerged as a strained croak. Lando stared at him across the table for an endless second. Then the gambler smiled slightly. Very well. Slowly, he reached over and turned up his cards. Han stared unbelievingly at the losing hand, then slowly he raised his eyes to regard his friend. Lando smiled wryly and shrugged.
Gotta hand it to you, buddy, the gambler said. I thought I could bluff you.
Lando was bluffing. The Corellian's head whirled as it sank in. I won! I can't believe it, I won! Slowly, deliberately, he laid down his card chips. Pure sabak, he said. The dealer nodded.
Captain Solo is our tournament winner, gentle beings,
he said, speaking into the tiny amplifier attached to his collar.
Congratulations, Captain Solo.
You're a better player than I ever gave you credit for, old man, Lando said genially.
Han wondered how Lando could be so composed when he'd just lost so much. Then he reflected that the gambler had probably won and lost fortunes before. Han picked up the data card that was Lando's marker and studied it.
So, what ship are you going to claim? Lando asked. I've got an almost new YT-2400 Corelli Systems light stock freighter that would be your best bet.
Wait till you... I'm taking the Falcon, Han said in a rush. Lando's eyebrows went up.
The Millennium Falcon? He said, obviously dismayed. Oh, no. Han, that's my own personal vessel. That was never part of the deal.
You said any ship in your stock, Han reminded him, levelly. Their eyes locked. I claim the Falcon. Slowly, deliberately, Lando nodded.
Nobody can say I don't honor my markers.
Han grinned, then threw both arms up into the air and whirled around in an impromptu dance, giddy with joy. Wait till I tell Chewie, the Millennium Falcon is mine! At last, a ship of our own. Bria Theron stood alone in the deserted Hollow Lounge, watching Han Solo as he rejoiced in his victory, wishing she could be there to hug him, kiss him, celebrate with him. It was late on the night of the fourth day of meetings, and the Corellian commander's talks with the Duros, the Sullustan, and the Alderaanians would conclude tomorrow morning. They'd made progress in reaching some agreements, and all of them had learned a great deal about each other's culture, but nothing major had been decided. None of the three other rebel groups had been willing to commit to Corellia's proposed rebel alliance. Bria sighed. It was obvious that there was still a long way to go. It was a sultry day on Nal Hutta, but one Hutt was too intent on his holocast unit to even notice the weather. Durga, the new leader of the Basadi clan since his parent Eric's untimely death 6 months ago, had eyes and attention only for the full-sized holo image projected into his office. 2 months after Eric's death, Durga had hired a team of the best forensic examiners in the Empire to conduct a rigorous autopsy on his parent's bloated corpse. Now Durga stared at the coalescing holo image of the leader of the team of forensic specialists, Mick Bidlore. The scientist drew a deep breath.
We have discovered a very rare substance concentrated in the tissues of Lord Arik's brain. The substance is not natural. None of my team has ever encountered it before. We are running tests even now to discover its properties.
Durga's birthmarked face grew even uglier as his scowl deepened.
I knew it,
he said. The scientist raised a cautioning hand.
Lord Durga, please allow us to finish our tests.
Durga waved a dismissive hand at the forensics expert.
Very well. See that you report to me instantly when you discover what we are dealing with here.
Durga was not the only unhappy hut on Nalhutta. Jabba Dasilajic Tior, second in command of the powerful Dasilajic clan, was both depressed and displeased. Jabba had spent the entire morning with his aunt, Jiliak, the leader of Dasilajic, finishing the report on the losses to Dasilajic that had resulted from the Imperial attempt to raise Nar Shaddaa and subjugate Nalhutta. The Empire's attack had failed, mostly due to Jabba and Jiliak's successful bribe of the Imperial Admiral, but it would be a long time before business on Nar Shaddaa was back to normal.
"Shipping is down 40%, Aunt,"
Jabba said, his comparatively small, delicate fingers touching the data pad expertly.
"We lost many ships when that thrice-cursed Sarn Shield mounted that attack. Our spice customers have been complaining that we can't move our product the way we used to."
Jiliak replied with a mighty belch. Jabba looked up and saw that she was eating again, some high-sustenance goop she smeared on the backs of her swamp wrigglers before stuffing them into her enormous mouth.
"You'd better be careful," Jabba warned. "Those wrigglers gave you terrible indigestion the other day, remember?"
Jiliak belched again.
"You're right. I should cut back, but the baby needs the nourishment."
Jabba sighed. Jiliak's infant was still spending much of its time inside its mother's pouch. Baby huts depended upon their mothers for all their nourishment for the first year of their lives. Jiliak burped delicately, then yawned. She simply wasn't interested in the affairs of Dasilajic the way she had been before motherhood. It was probably hormonal.
"Aunt, I would like to discuss..."
But Jabba was interrupted by a snort, then a buzzing nasal rumble, and turned to see that Jiliak's massive eyes were closed, and her mouth was half open as she snored. Jabba sighed and went back to work. That same night, Durga the Hutt was eating his evening repast when his majordomo, a servile, pale Chevin humanoid, appeared. "Master, there has been a message sent. You are to expect an important holo transmission from Coruscant within a few minutes." Waving the bowing Chevin out of the room, Durga activated the security locks, keyed on the shielded frequency field, then accepted the communication. A blonde human female suddenly stood before him, nearly life-sized.
"Lord Durga,"
she said,
"I am Guri, aide to Prince Shizor. The prince would like to speak with you personally."
Eric the Hutt had not raised a fool, so none of Durga's unease showed. Instead, he inclined his head the closest a Hutt could come to a humanoid bow.
"The prince honors me."
The transmission field was almost instantly filled by the tall, imposing form of the feline prince, Shizor, the leader of the huge criminal empire known as Black Sun. Shizor's people, the feline, had evolved from a reptilian species, though the prince was very humanoid in appearance. His skin had a definite greenish cast, and his eyes were flat and expressionless.
"Greetings, Lord Durga. How is Basadi doing in the wake of your esteemed parents' untimely death?"
"Basadi is doing well, Your Highness," Durga said. "Your help was most appreciated, I assure you."
When Durga had first succeeded to the leadership of Basadi, he'd faced so much opposition from other leaders in the clan, mostly due to the young Hutt's unfortunate facial birthmark, which Hutt lore held to be an extremely bad omen, that he'd had to ask Prince Shizor for help. Within a week after his request, Durga's three main opponents and detractors had died in unrelated accidents. Opposition had grown far quieter after that. Durga had paid Shizor for his help, but the prince's fee had been so modest, so much less than the young Hutt Lord was expecting, that Eric's heir knew he hadn't seen the last of Black Sun.
"I was only too glad to provide whatever assistance you needed, Lord Durga,"
Shizor said.
"And I must say, it is my most humble wish that we will have cause to work together again. My sources reveal that you may need some assistance in discovering the truth behind your parents' death. Apparently some irregularities have surfaced."
How did he learn about the forensic report so quickly?
Durga wondered. Then he mentally shook himself. This was Black Sun he was talking to, the greatest criminal organization in the entire galaxy. It was possible that not even the Emperor himself had better spy networks. Shizor inclined his head respectfully.
I am sure my sources could be of considerable assistance to you.
He looked Durga square in the eye.
Lord Durga, let me be frank. Black Sun's interests in the Outer Rim are not being served as capably as they could be. It seems to me that we would do well to ally ourselves with the natural masters of that region of space, the Hutts.
Durga flashed back to a conversation with his parent.
The power of Black Sun is seductive, my child, Eric had said. But beware it, for there is no turning back as long as Prince Shizor is alive. Easier in some ways to say no to the Emperor himself. Give Black Sun a kilometer and they will take a parsec. Remember this, Durga.
I remember,
Durga thought, and faced the hollow image squarely.
I will think upon your words, Prince Shizor, but at the moment, Hut custom demands that I pursue my investigations and possible vengeance as a sacred and solo trust.
Shizor inclined his head again.
I quite understand, Lord Durga. I shall look forward to hearing from you when you have had the time to ponder my proposal.
Thank you, Your Highness, Durga said. Your concern honors me, and your friendship pleases me.
The moment the prince's hollow image vanished, Durga let himself slump. He felt exhausted after fencing with the Feline prince, but congratulated himself that he'd held up rather well. Far away on Imperial Center, Prince Shizor turned away from his comm unit.
Not just a crafty Hut, but an eloquent one, it seems, he commented to his human replica assassin droid, Guri. Durga is proving more of a challenge than I expected.
The HRD, who bore the appearance of a surpassingly beautiful human woman, made a very subtle movement of one hand, yet the meaning and menace in her gesture were unmistakable.
Why not eliminate him, then, my prince? Easy enough to do.
Shizor nodded.
For you, Guri, not even a Hut's thick skin would prove a challenge, I know, he said, but killing a potential opponent is not nearly so efficient and effective as making him a dedicated subordinate.
Understood, my prince, Guri replied composedly. What is your plan?
I shall give Durga time to realize just how much he needs Black Sun, Shizor replied. Guri, have Durga's investigations into Eric's death closely monitored. I want our operatives to stay ahead of Durga's own knowledge of the forensics team's findings. I wish to know how Eric died before the Basadi Lord does.
Han Solo arrived back at his shabby flat on Nar Shaddaa in the early hours of the morning.
Hey, everyone!
The Corellian bellowed.
Chewie, wake up! I won!
After a round of backslapping and congratulations, Han and Chewie headed immediately for Lando's used spaceship lot with Lando's marker in hand. Han stood there with his friend, contemplating his ship, dreaming of how he'd modify the YT-1300 into the ultimate smuggling ship.
Fake compartments, he muttered. I'm going to build some fake compartments under the decking.
Then he thought for a moment.
And our first port of call is going to be Kashyyyk. I'd say a nice load of bowcaster explosive querals would probably do well there. What do you think, Chewie?
Chewbacca voiced his agreement long and loud. The Wookiee was more excited at the prospect of going home than Han had ever seen him before. Two days later, with the Falcon's new below-decks compartments crammed with contraband, Han Solo, with Chewie in the co-pilot's seat, flew his ship out of Shug Ninx's space barn, exulting in the Millennium Falcon's quick acceleration. Kashyyyk was an Imperial protectorate. Translation, slave world. The Imperials had managed to pacify the inhabitants, though they kept their forays into Wookiee cities and homes to a minimum, and they always went heavily armed and in numbers. Wookiees were known to have quick tempers and to act impulsively. Han managed to dodge the imp patrols and to stay out of range of any sensor satellites as he approached the verdant sphere that was Kashyyyk.
The Wookiee homeworld was mostly forest, covered with monstrous rocher trees. As they neared Chewie's hometown, Rukwaro, a kilometer-wide city set on platforms made by crisscrossing branches of the rochers, Han's co-pilot made him sheer off in a dangerous swoop and take them straight down between the branches for a 30-second plunge. Even though it looked through the viewport as though they were going to be engulfed and smashed to flinders, nothing touched the ship. Chewie barked an order, and Han shouted, "Hard to port, now!" He sent the Falcon into a screaming left turn, then before him saw something that the Corellian at first took to be a huge cave, a vast black hole waiting to swallow them up. But as he neared it, Han realized that in actuality it was a massive rocher branch balanced across other equally huge branches. The branch had split off from the main tree and been hollowed out to form a cave the size of a small Imperial docking bay. Han killed the last of their forward motion, then lowered them onto their landing struts using his repulsors. Hitting the open ramp release, Han raced down the ramp, then stopped in wonder. "Wow," Han muttered. The inside of the cave was a well-stocked, completely functional docking site and repair facility.
"This is something."
Han followed Chewie toward the front of the cave, where he was introduced to a crowd of Wookiees. Chewbacca was howled at, hugged, thumped, shaken, thumped some more, and generally exclaimed over with great joy. When Chewie introduced Han as his honor brother, to whom he owed a life debt because Han had freed him from slavery, Han in turn was in grave danger of being similarly thumped and shaken, but thankfully, Chewbacca intervened. Three of the Wookiees Han met were relatives of Chewie's. A Wookiee with whorls of auburn hair turned out to be his sister, Calibo. The other four were members of the Wookiee Underground Resistance Movement who had come in especially to meet Han and negotiate for his cargo. Katara was the Underground Resistance leader, as near as Han could tell, and the Wookiees listened to her with a great deal of respect. After several minutes of confusion, Chewbacca roared an order to his friends. Han caught most of it. Something about, "Fetch the Q-lar." A long bag-like piece of woven fabric, or was it woven hair, was produced. Han stared at his friend. "You want me to crawl into that thing so you can carry me up the trees?" Han shook his head. "I'm gonna regret this," he muttered, and climbed into the sack. For the next few minutes, all Han could do was try not to move and to keep concentrating on not being sick. The sack swung and jerked and spun and slapped against the tree trunks. Finally, the movement stopped, and Han found himself lying on the ground, still inside the Q-lar. When the world around him stopped spinning, the Corellian began clawing his way out of the sack. Moments later, he was standing, legs braced wide apart for balance, on the platform where the great, mostly enclosed city of Rukwaro was located. The Corellian turned. "Hey, Chewie, what a way to travel. Good thing your people brought that sack along. What do you usually carry in them, luggage?" Chewbacca's lip curled, then he gave a brief, amused translation of the word Q-lar. Han bristled. "Baby sack? You haul Wook babies around in him?" Chewbacca began to laugh, and the madder his human friend got, the more the Wookiee cracked up. Han was rescued by a roar from a party of Wookiees coming their way from the city. He noted a somewhat stooped, short, graying Wookiee, and just then Chewbacca took off, racing towards the newcomers with roars of joy. Chewbacca's sister confirmed that that was Atachitkuk, their father. "There's someone else that Chewie's looking forward to seeing," Han said. "Mulatto Buck. Does she still live here in Rukwaro?" Calibo's formidable teeth flashed in a Wookiee grin, and she nodded, human style. "She married?" Han asked, dreading the answer. He had some idea of how much that question meant to his best friend. Calibo's grin widened as slowly, deliberately, she shook her head. "No." Han grinned back. "Woohoo! That's something to celebrate, I guess." Han felt a touch on his shoulder and turned to find Katara standing there with yet another male Wookiee. To Han's profound astonishment, this Wookiee opened his mouth and said, in amazingly understandable Wookiee, "Greetings, Captain Solo. I am Ralrutine. Please call me Ralra." Han's mouth dropped open with surprise. This Wookiee spoke in a fashion that Han could understand very easily and could even have reproduced. "Hey," he blurted out, "how'd you do that?"
"A speech impediment,"
the Wookiee said.
Unfortunate for me when conversing with my own people, but with humans it is useful.
Katara was eager to begin negotiations over the cargo of explosive quarrels, and Ralra translated.
We need them desperately,
Ralra said.
But we are not asking for charity. We have something to trade for them, Captain.
And what's that? Han wondered.
Armor from Imperial stormtroopers,
Ralra said. Han shrugged. Used armor ain't worth much. Which wasn't true. A suit of stormtrooper armor in good shape was worth well over 2,000 credits, depending on the market. Ralra spoke Katara's vehement words.
I know that the armor is valuable because the female from your world of Corellia, with hair the color of sunrise, told me so.
Han's attention was suddenly focused completely on the underground leader. A Corellian woman? He said sharply. Fair-haired? What did she look like? I may know this Corellian. She may be... He hesitated. She may be my mate. We were separated long ago by the Empire. Which was true, strictly speaking. Bria had left when Han was preparing to go into the Imperial Academy, saying she didn't want to hold him back. Ralra made a gesture in the air on the level of Han's nose.
This tall,
he said.
Long hair, golden red. Eyes the color of our sky, not wide.
His hands described a slender form.
She told us she had been a slave on the planet Elysia, and she would give her life to free Kashyyyk and any other world enslaved by the Empire. She spoke with much passion.
Bria, Han thought numbly. Bria, a member of the Corellian Rebellion? How in the galaxy did that happen? It was wonderful to be back on his own world. Chewbacca hadn't realized how much he'd missed his home. In addition to all Chewbacca's friends and family, there was Malatabuk. The Wookiee female was even lovelier than Chewie had remembered, and her shy blue glance was even more intriguing. The two spent long hours wandering the bow trails, looking up at the nighttime sky, hearing the soft sounds of the arboreal dwellers. They did not talk much, but their silence was filled with unspoken things. On his third day on Kashyyyk, Chewbacca decided it was time to go hunting for a Quillerat. Capturing and killing a Quillerat was something of a challenge because the beasts could actually hurl their quills at a hunter. To complicate matters, tradition declared that the Quillerat must be hunted barehanded and killed by blows delivered by a Wookiee's own strength. The Wookiee kept every sense alert, eyes scanning, ears listening for the faintest rustle, nostrils twitching. Quillerats had a distinctive, and to a Wookiee, enticing odor. Chewie's step slowed, then stopped, every muscle poised. There, amid those leaves, the Quillerat froze, sensing danger. Chewie leaped, shield held out. Suddenly, the air before him was filled with a rain of quills. They thudded into the shield for the most part, though a few embedded themselves in the Wookiee's shoulders and chest. Chewbacca's right hand went out, and he grabbed the Quillerat by the quilled tail. The terrified animal squawked, turned to bite, but it was too late. Chewie heaved it up and sent it thudding hard against the bough beneath his feet. Stunned, the animal went limp, and another quick swing dispatched it altogether. Wrapping the Quillerat in the woven bag he'd brought, the Wookiee began a triumphant journey back to Rukwaro. He located Malatabuk wandering along a little-used trail. Mala, Chewie said, I have something for you, a gift that I hope you will accept. As he stopped before her, Chewbacca, in one fluid motion, knelt and removed the Quillerat from its bag. His heart was pounding. Mala stared at him for a long moment. Chewbacca, you have been long away from your people. Do you remember our customs? Do you know what you are offering? Relief flooded Chewie, for her tone was bantering, flirtatious. I know, he replied. My memory is good. In all the years I was gone, I never for a moment forgot your face, your strength, your eyes, Malatabuk. I dreamed of the day that we could be married. Will you take me for your husband? She replied in the traditional manner by cautiously picking up the stiffening Quillerat and taking a big bite out of its soft underbelly. Chewie's heart was flooded with joy. She accepts me. We are betrothed. Getting up off his knees, he followed Mala to a sheltered niche behind a screen of leaves. There they sat down close together and shared the Quillerat. "I had proposals, you know," Malatabuck said. "People told me I was foolish for waiting so long. They said you were dead, that you would never return to Kashyyyk. But I knew somehow. I knew that was not so. I waited, and now my joy fills the world." Tenderly, Chewbacca licked blood and tissue off her face, washing her as she returned the favor. "Mala, you know about the life debt I have pledged to Han Solo?" Chewie asked, as, sated, they sat back, arms around each other. Mala's voice quivered just a tiny bit. "I know. I cherish your honor as my own, my husband-to-be. But let us be married quickly, so we may have as much time together as possible before you and Captain Solo must depart." "Nothing would please me more," Chewie said. "How quickly can you be ready? How long will it take to prepare your wedding veil?" She chuckled, a rich, throaty sound in the darkness. "It has been ready for 50 years, Chewbacca. Ready and waiting." Chewbacca's heart was full of love and pride. "Tomorrow, then, Mala. Tomorrow, Chewbacca." Tirawenza, high priest of Yalisha, lounged back in his resting sling, watching Kibik, Yalisha's figurehead hut overlord, trying to go over last month's accounts and make sense of them. Kibik was an idiot, and it was Tirawenza's unfortunate task to bring him up to speed on the running of Yalisha for Durga and Basadi. Here on Yalisha, religious pilgrims were recruited by Talanda Til missionaries during traveling revival shows. Anyone unfortunate enough to fall prey to the addictive exaltation would follow the Yalishan missionaries to the steaming jungle planet. There, the malnourished, brainwashed, and addicted pilgrims became willing slaves in the Yalishan spice factories, toiling from sunup to sundown for their Yalishan masters. Tirawenza's people were distant cousins of the Huts, though they were far smaller and more mobile. With their huge bodies balanced on trunk-like legs, the Talanda Til had a broad face that rather resembled a Hutt's countenance, but with the addition of a single long horn just above their nostrils. A long, whip-like tail was carried curled over their backs. Their arms and hands were tiny and weak compared to the rest of them. The most interesting feature of the Talanda Til males, however, was not physical. They possessed the ability to project empathic, feel-good emotions at most humans. These empathic projections, coupled with a soothing vibration produced in the male's throat sacs, were like a jolt of a powerful drug to the pilgrims. They quickly became addicted to their daily fix and believed that the priests were divinely gifted. Nothing was further from the truth, however. The Talanda Til's ability was simply an adaptation of a male mating display, evolutionarily developed to attract Talanda Til females.
"Tirawenza," Kibik said fretfully, "I don't understand this. Why do we have to spend extra credits on weapons and shields on our ships? They're only carrying slaves, after all. Who cares if raiders take them?"
Kibik was referring to a raid a month ago by a group of human rebels on a slave ship.
"Your Excellency," Tirawenza replied with exaggerated patience, "ships are expensive. Having big holes blown in them tends to render them unusable, or at least very expensive to repair."
"Oh," said Kibik, his brow furrowing. "Yes, I guess that would be correct. Very well."
"Idiot," thought Tirawenza. Still mumbling, Kibik went back to his records. Tirawenza relaxed back into his sling and allowed himself the luxury of a roll of his bulbous eyes. Safe in the privacy of his office on Nal Hutta, Durga the Hutt wriggled closer to Mick Bidlore's hollow image as it solidified.
"You have news about the autopsy results? You have identified the substance?"
"Your Excellency, the substance is a poison. We have traced its origin to the planet Malki. It is so rare that we have been unable to find a name for it. We call it X-1 for want of a better name."
"Someone fed my parent a fatal dose of poison," Durga said, his voice going cold and deadly with rage.
Not exactly, Your Excellency."
The specialist licked his lips nervously.
"The scheme was not nearly so obvious as that. It was actually rather ingenious."
If it was that clever, it must certainly have been a Hutt, Durga thought. He glared at the scientist.
"What, then?"
The substance is deadly in large quantities, Lord Durga, but in small quantities it would not kill. Instead, it concentrates in the brain tissues, causing the victim to experience a progressive deterioration of the thought processes. And the substance is also highly addictive. Once the victim grew accustomed to ingesting it in high enough doses, the abrupt withdrawal of the substance would cause the symptoms you described. Racking pain, convulsions, and death.
He took a breath.
And that, Lord Durga, is why your parent died. Not from the X-1 in his system, but from its abrupt withdrawal.
The specialist hesitated.
Lord Durga, our investigations also revealed that X-1 is very expensive. So only a person or persons of great wealth could have purchased enough of it to kill your parent.
Durga broke the connection and undulated back and forth across his office, fuming.
Eric was murdered. I knew it all along.
Wealth enough to buy X-1. It has to be Dasilajic, Jiliak, or perhaps Jabba. I will find the one responsible for this, and I will kill him or her with my own hands. I swear it to my dead parent. I will have vengeance.
Jabba the Hutt and his aunt Jiliak were lounging together in their palatial receiving room in Jiliak's palace on Nalhutta, watching Jiliak's baby inch its way around the room. At this stage of its life, the little creature resembled a huge, chubby grub or insect larva more than a Hutt. Hutt babies were born almost mindless, and Hutt youngsters did not reach the age of accountability until they were about a century old. Before that, they were looked upon as creatures who needed good care and feeding, and not much else.
Aunt, Jabba said, I have read the newest report from our source in the Basadi accounting office, and their profits are impressive. Even the dissension over Durga's leadership has not slowed them. Yelisha continues to produce more processed spice with every month that passes. Shiploads of pilgrims are arriving nearly every week. It is depressing.
Jiliak turned her massive head to regard her nephew.
Durga has done better than I ever gave him credit for, Jabba. By now I envisioned that Basadi would be ripe for our takeover. But even though there is muttering and discontent with Durga's leadership, his outspoken opponents are dead, and no one has surfaced to replace them within the clan.
Jabba blinked at his aunt, and a spark of hope awakened. That speech sounded almost like the old pre-motherhood Jiliak.
Do you know why they are dead, Aunt?
Because Durga was foolish enough to deal with Black Sun, Jiliak said. Only Prince Caesar would be so coldly daring as to assassinate them all within days of each other.
Jiliak was shaking her head slowly back and forth, a mannerism she'd picked up from humans.
Prince Caesar is not one to be trifled with. Durga will soon discover that he has opened a door that cannot easily be closed. If he steps through it, he will no longer be his own master.
So should we hope he does that, Aunt?
Jiliak's eyes narrowed slightly.
Hardly, nephew. Caesar is not a foe I wish to contend with. He has evidently set his sights on Basadi, but he would willingly take Dasilajic too. Of that I have no doubt.
Jabba silently agreed. Caesar would move in on the whole of Nalhutta if given the opportunity.
Speaking of Basadi, Aunt, he said, what of these Yelishan prophets I was reporting on? What can we do to stop Basadi? They now have 9 colonies on Yelisha. They are preparing to start another colony on Nirvona, the other habitable world in the system.
Jiliak thought for a moment.
Perhaps it is time to utilize Tiruenza again, she said. Durga apparently has no suspicion that he was responsible for Arik's death.
Utilize him how?
I don't know yet, Jiliak said. Perhaps we can encourage Tiruenza to declare his independence from Durga. If they fought, Basadi prophets would be bound to plummet, and then we could pick up the pieces.
Very good, Aunt.
Jabba was happy to hear the old scheming Jiliak acting like herself again.
Now if I can just report on these figures here and get your input on reducing our costs and...
Jabba broke off, interrupted by Jiliak's deep, maternal coo of affection, and saw the baby hut wriggling up to its mother, tiny vestigial arms held up.
Look, nephew!
Jiliak's voice was warm, indulgent.
My little one knows Mama, yes, doesn't he, precious?
Jabba rolled his eyes.
Witness the demise of one of the greatest criminal minds of this millennium, he thought bleakly.
Then, as Jiliak scooped up the baby hut and guided it back into her pouch, Jabba glared at the little creature with an expression very close to outright hatred.